It's time to lean back and buckle in. This ain't your grandma's early learning podcast. Then again, your grandma probably didn't know what a podcast was. Hey, moms and dads, puppies and kittens, caregivers and advocates, it's time for Shaken Bones. Here's Dan and Amy.
Hi there. Welcome to the Shaken Bones podcast. I'm Dan Hodgins.
And I'm Amy Avila.
In this episode, we're talking about something called Revered. Are those people human also? Amy and I are hanging out together to tackle the untouchables. Sometimes we might challenge your beliefs, maybe even stretch your comfort zone, but most importantly, we want to make you think. We don't expect that you have to agree or disagree, but what we do hope is to cause some shaken bones. You know, Amy and I were really fortunate. We just got off of a major pep rally for play held in Maryland. And one of the things that came up near the closure of that rally was a topic about revere, looking at people in a different way than we might look at ourselves. So we thought this might be a topic in general, because I'm wondering whether or not people do that with each other, and sometimes with people in our society. So sometimes, let's start with the field. Sometimes I think that people view presenters at different levels of being human. What do you think, Amy?
Oh, definitely. And I'm guilty of that as well, Dan, because, you know, when you look at somebody and you go to a session and they really open your eyes and they really give you a lot of ideas and you see them as a mentor and maybe someone who's a little bit further in the journey towards play or a little bit further in your philosophy than you are, it's really easy to, you know, to put them kind of on a pedestal. And sometimes it's really easy to forget that people are human as well.
And I think, people are afraid sometimes to ask questions. Sometimes they're just so frazzled by the appearance of the presenter that they sometimes aren't even listening perhaps to what that person is saying, because they get so caught up with that idealism that maybe this person's at a different level than me, when in reality we all started at some level and then moved in different perspectives and with different ideas. I know that there are people that I would consider my mentors. I don't know if I put them on a pedestal, but I certainly appreciate the fact of what they've offered to me in terms of my own professional knowledge. Are there people like that in your lives too?
Definitely. There are a lot of people that I look up to in terms of, you know, like I said, where different people are in their journey. And, you know, some of the people I've met in real life, which is absolutely awesome. And some of the people are just, you know, people I've connected with online, with, you know, the advances in social media, the opportunity to connect with people who are, you know, on similar paths as we are from all places around the world has just been phenomenal. You know, there are a couple people in Australia who I've been in really good contact with since I started my blog. And one of them, she's always saying, you know, it's like we're living the same life halfway around the world from each other. And so it's just really nice to, you know, to see that. And I think what part of, you know, where this comes into play when we're talking about presenters and other people, Dan, is the fact that when you're a presenter, you know, you're up there and you're showing the different pieces of your program or your journey, or you're sharing the research. And sometimes we don't tend to share the goofs or the things that tend to make us a little more human. And social media is good for that too, because you're seeing a second or a glimpse, and you're not seeing the whole picture all of the time. That, you know, we're all human and we're all on this path, and you know, everybody's got days that are just a little bit more challenging than others.
Right. I know sometimes when I'm presenting, I have to remind people that I started someplace too, and the way I was 36 years ago is not the way I am now, and that essentially that I made all those quote goofs too. And sometimes I look back and wonder, why was I like that? Could that have possibly been me in terms of the approach? I remember at one point in my life having children come to circle time, you know, sitting in chairs with their fingers under the bottom, and I'm thinking, I cannot believe that that was me that occurred at that time. You know, I'm wondering also, you know, with parents and guardians especially, sometimes we take people's words as if they don't need to be researched at all. I keep thinking about people who might hear from a teacher in a setting, and that they might be talking about their child, and that in reality the parent might have a total different view of that child, but because the teacher said it, that person must know more than me. I wonder sometimes if that happens.
You know, I'm certain that it does, and I think that, you know, not just with teachers, but with doctors or professionals you might be working with. I know personally, you know, looking back and knowing what I know now, when my son was younger, he really didn't start talking until after he was four. And my husband's from Denmark, and we have a bilingual home, and so we were speaking both Danish and English at home. And because he wasn't talking and he wasn't following the quote unquote normal, you know, normal speech development, the speech and language therapist asked us to stop speaking Danish at home. And so we did. Yeah. And so we did, because, of course, we, you know, being parents and trying to do what was the best for our child, we kind of took her word as, you know, okay, she's a speech and language pathologist. She's got to know better than we do in terms of this. And we really didn't do as much research as I wish we would have at that point. And we stopped speaking Danish at home. Well, you know, all the concerns that they had with my son's speech and language development, he turned about 4.5. And instead of the typical development of, you know, sounds and words and different things, he just started speaking in sentences. And so, you know, we lost a lot of time with the dual language with him, because we listened to the other, you know, to the speech and language pathologists. And, you know, afterwards and going more into early childhood and taking more classes, I realized that, you know, a lot of times children from dual language homes will start speaking much later. And, you know, I regret the fact that we stopped speaking Danish when we did. But, you know, we picked it up later, and everybody goes through those things in their lives. But yeah, it was one of those things where we just took her word for it because of her position in her profession, when we really could have, you know, looked into it a little bit more ourselves.
Yeah, I think sometimes I know that when I have sat on some individualized education plans, one of the things that I have found that happens frequently as a parent is you might sense that the people at the table, the professionals, might know more than you know about your child. And I think what you just related, I think that happens often, where the parent forgets that they probably know their child more than anybody else, but because the professionals in the room are using a language that might not be something that the parent is used to using, or that it might be simply easier for the professionals to make a plan that might not fit the child. So I think that sometimes that carries over to a point where individuals sometimes forget what they really know and need to use with children and other adults around them, so that they begin to comprehend their child a lot better. I remember with my daughter, one of the concerns like yours was the fact that she also didn't speak until she was about 4 years of age, and again spoke a lot after that, and continued to speak quite fluently, and now speaks several languages differently. But at the beginning, even though I know my child better, I was getting the impression that perhaps I needed to do some things that I wasn't comfortable with that was being suggested, until I realized, you know, I knew Jennifer better than anybody else, and I probably needed to help them understand her too. I think that happens more, don't you?
Definitely. You know, and I have a lot of parents that come to me with questions after they've read a book or they've seen the doctor or, you know, are working with specialists to get another opinion when they're not quite sure. And I think it's sometimes, I don't think we give parents enough credit sometimes, because parents do know their children better than anyone else does. And granted, they might not have the same specialization or education, but you know, each child is different and each parent is going to know their child best. So the combination of, you know, the parent knowing their child and doing some research, I think, you know, can combat some of those times when we aren't quite sure that a specialist is giving the best information for the child.
Yeah. Do you think that providers and teachers view each other differently in a program and at some point might view that as competitive or jealous, or look at somebody who's had more experience or knowledge might be better than me, so I might be intimidated by that? Do you think that occurs in the field at all?
I do. I think there's a lot of, you know, there's this big stigma between if you're a home-based provider or a center provider, or, you know, or if you work in the schools. And if you look like at society in general, in terms of where, when the government is bringing funding down, home providers are not compensated this at the same rates as center providers are for providing childcare. When you're looking at public assistance. And I so think so there's some of that societal type thing of where, you know, our care isn't valued as much in terms of monetarily. And so I think there's also a stigma sometimes in terms of, you know, this type of setting or that type of setting is better than the other. And in addition, I do know that, some providers are held at a higher esteem than other providers are. And, you know, they're putting in all these quality rating programs where they're giving stars to different providers too, that don't necessarily have the research or the backing for how they're giving the stars, which is adding additional stigma to various providers.
Yeah, I think that's happening in our society in terms of the criterias, the ratings, the accreditation standards, perhaps, the thought might be that a program that has that particular rating must be better than a program that does not. And it could simply relate to the fact that they weren't able to afford to go through the process, they weren't able to look at some of the standards and feel that they were appropriate. So it might not necessarily be reflective in whether or not a person has a better program, but other things that can come into that. I do believe that sometimes that kind of approach does create standards that might have somebody view each other differently in terms of better or worse, and I'm concerned where that might head.
You know, when the STARS program started coming through to Michigan, and were some of that, all I could think of were the Sneetches, and you know who's got STARS and who doesn't, and you know, and how that all hooked together, and you know. In our area here in the Upper Peninsula, we have a wonderful network of providers. And, you know, some places I know it's much more competitive than others, but here in Marquette County, you know, we have a secret Facebook group for providers so that we can support each other. And when people have questions, because when you work at home by yourself or with one other person, you don't really have colleagues to bounce ideas off of. And that's really important for continued growth. And so, you know, I think that we work very well and we have a good community going where we don't have a lot of the looking at different people at different levels. But it takes a lot of work for that to happen too. And, you know, everyone's commitment to being part of that community, but we make referrals to each other. We help each other out when, you know, if somebody's got openings, we know when the phone rings, who to send people to. And, you know, it's a wonderful way for us to work together versus, you know, having that jealousy or that sense of competition between each other, because really, you know, as a community, we're all in this together to provide the best programs and the best we can for parents and for young children.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes what happens is that as we view each other, I always like to look at the fact that some people have strengths that I do not have, or they might have some challenges that I do not have. And I think that those kinds of things is what makes us different in our approaches. So I think what you're indicating is quite important because we all want to support each other because we do have some goals in mind, and that's to make quality program for children and families. So I think it's important that we view each other as having those differences that make it important for us to work together in our approach. I do think society still views childcare, whether you're doing it at home in a center, at a different level than preschool. And I'm not sure what made that happen, but I remember that when people came in to visit the program that I had, one of the things that they often asked was, "Do you have a preschool program?" And I would always ask them, "What do you mean by a preschool program? Do you mean do we provide children with the following things?" Yes, but I'm not sure what they meant by a preschool program. Do you think there's different levels of that still, Amy, in terms of the people's perspectives?
I see it all the time, Dan. I get asked a lot, and a lot of home providers a lot of times are called babysitters, and we don't like the term babysitter at all because we've never sat on babies before. And in terms of feeling more of a professional, and I think, as a community, again, I'm gonna, the group that I'm working with home-based providers, the Facebook group that we have for our local area, we work really hard to educate parents as much as we can in terms of, we don't have a quote-unquote preschool program because we are not going to do things that are not necessarily developmentally, not developmentally appropriate. Because a lot of times when parents are looking for preschool in our area, they're looking for worksheets, they're looking for a lot of teacher-led types of things. And so it's a lot of giving them the education on what the brain research says and what is best for young children and what is developmentally appropriate for them to be doing. I share a lot of research with parents in terms of play. And I have a waiting list, Dan. I don't have an opening until the fall of 2017 right now. That's our next.
Wow.
Yeah, that's our next foreseen opening. But I spend hours every week on the phone with parents calling who are looking for care and referring them in different directions and giving them, well, is this really what you're looking for? And, passing information along to them because I feel that even though their children are not coming to me, it's important for them to know what's out there and to give them some of that information that they can look into themselves and then make the best decision for their child at that point.
Yeah, and I think parents need help and support in that direction because it's a field that's very different, and people use different approaches with children. And I think that there is, through media and other sources, we're asking parents to make some decisions that are that they don't have some clear information about. So I always look at the parent that comes, that might be going out purchasing a car. They've done quite a bit of work to decide how much they can afford, what that car looks like, is it going to meet their needs, etc. And there's been talk that people spend a lot less time looking for the appropriate childcare for their own family than they do at purchasing an automobile. So I think part of it is we need to help people understand that the field is complex. It has a variety of levels, and that we need to look at. Help them look at what might be appropriate for them and their children. And I think working together to create that is an important component in our society.
Yes, and it's being a parent myself, and I know you're a parent as well. It's hard. I mean, you want to do the best for your child, and you have all of this different information coming at you from all over the place, and you hop on Pinterest and you see all of this stuff that's, you know, teacher directed, and you're hearing about the, you know, all these things that people need to do or children need to be able to do before kindergarten now, and, you know, all of these different pressures that are coming down. And then you're looking into, you know, childcare programs and schools, and you know, I mean, some places in the country, there are schools that are, you know, like university prep already in preschool, that which is just absolutely ridiculous in my mind. But as a parent, it's, you know, what do you do? There's just so much information out there.
Yeah, and I think helping parents maybe ask particular types of questions, make sure that they have an opportunity to observe, and they need to be aware that that is okay to have that input and that interest in where they're placing their child. I'm wondering whether or not there is a time, as we're talking about this, is there a time when it's okay to put somebody in some kind of revere status? Is there a time when that's okay?
You know, when this happened at the pep rally, I sat down and I thought about it a lot. And I went to the dictionary and I looked up exactly how they define revere. And it's listed as a feeling or attitude of deep respect tinged with awe. But then it also says to render with blind obedience. So looking at the dictionary definition of that, I would say yes to the first part, but I don't think rendering anyone with blind obedience is ever okay.
Well, plus think of that expectation in somebody too.
Yeah.
That you might fear to expect blind obligation. that you know, it'd be really tough to live up to that expectation.
Right. Right,
so
and you know, all the pressure.
So I'm wondering, what makes it happen? Why do people? I keep thinking there are groupies out there that follow several people, and I'm wondering what makes that happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we're drawn to people that have certain personalities based upon, you know, our own personalities. I think we're also drawn to people, at least I'm drawn to people who challenge me and who, you know, like I said earlier, maybe a little bit further along the path of the philosophy that I'm looking at. You know, and I think you can be a groupie without rendering with blind obedience.
I agree.
So
I just want to make sure that people, whoever they put at on that level, that they really think clearly about still what the person is saying, because I can't imagine anyone totally agreeing with something that somebody says. And I was having some conversation today with somebody who was relating the fact that if I were to be involved in some professional development myself as an attendee, what do I look for? And I agree with you. I'm looking for somebody that will challenge my thoughts, will use both sides of my brain, the emotion and the cognition. And I don't have to agree with them, but I want to be able to have some affirmation that things are that I believe is okay, but I also like the idea of having my thoughts challenged and people asking questions to try to further their own sets of knowledge, and that to me is how we get along together and working together for in this field and in what other fields. I can't imagine going to a doctor, for example, that I agreed with everything he or she said. So I would expect the same in the field, that we wouldn't have to necessarily agree or disagree, but there certainly should be an opportunity for questioning.
Yes, definitely. And also, you know, I think about when I first realized that it was okay to start following this play journey. And I think in the beginning, it was really easy for me to just like take everybody's word for things. Just because it was like, yes, this is what I, you know, this is kind of what I'm feeling, and this is what I want, and this is the direction I want to move in. And so it was really easy to take things that you were saying, or Bev Boss was saying, or Michael Lehman was saying, or, you know, other people that where I was going. And it was like, yes, these people are, you know, older than I am for one, and are further along in the path, and they're sharing information. That's wonderful. But, you know, then after a short period of time, it's like, you know, they've got a lot of great things to say, but then melding things to see what work best for me and my program. Because of course, some of the people that I met when I was first making the change and getting the affirmation towards, you know, what I want to do is okay. Because that's another thing too. It's like, oh, is this play journey an okay journey to be, you know, to be on, even though you kind of feel it in your heart at first, when everybody else is pushing academics, that you feel like, okay, am I doing the right thing here sometimes? But then really, you know, to be able to look at it and see how you can make the small changes and how your journey is going to look different, because your type of program may be completely different. You know, home programs are a lot different from center-based programs or co-op type programs, because, you know, the setting is just completely different. And a lot of people think we're nuts because we do childcare in our homes and the hours we run and those types of things. But, you know, it's, I love being a home provider, don't get me wrong, but I get a lot of crazy looks sometimes when people hear that, you know, we used to do 24/7 care and providing third shift and my husband and I working together and all those things that sometimes come with a home-based program. But, you know, being able to take what those other people were saying and work with what works for us and continually strive to do better along the way.
Yeah. I think it's important. I think part of that journey that you're talking about is what's important for us to focus at. You know, we're at the end of this Shaking Bones podcast. One of the things that I think both Amy and I agree here is that we're all at different levels of our growth and journey as we move forward. And that even those people that you might put at a different level than you because you have they have different experiences or different knowledge base, you know, they still take out the garbage. They still sit in the toilet like everybody else does. So I think it's important to remember that in terms of our process. If you have questions or want to continue this discussion, you can email me at dkj5075@aol.com or Amy at...
You can email me at amyahola@hotmail.com.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
This has been Shaking Bones. Dan and Amy will be back next week for more bone rattling. Stay tuned.